You probably now know that we have a show every 2 weeks, as we had for some time. It's now called Microsoft Networking Academy, but there is introductory sessions, so 200 level, where we go around fundamentals and we have a guest, partner spotlight, and there's a deep dive session. And this week is one of the deep dive sessions. And you can always email us at gbbanf@microsoft.com to receive detailed schedule of the upcoming sessions. And they're also available on Channel 9. So the agenda for today, oh, I forgot to remove the new show name. You guys know about that. Sorry, apologies. We'll do a deep dive on high availability and virtual networks. And I'm going to be driving this conversation for you. And it's specifically in the context of network virtual appliances, like firewalls and device of the kind. So the topic being that, I'll start with a little bit of the virtual network topologies, because they are, you know, used in scenarios where those firewalls, I'm going to talk primarily around firewalls, but you could imagine other devices, virtual routers could do something similar and would need a similar configuration as well. So if you have independent virtual networks, that means that, for example, you have one virtual network where you have some firewalls, maybe a pair of firewalls for outbound access, maybe another pair of firewalls for stuff that comes from on-premise through that express route circuit, or it could also be through a VPN connection. But that's good for one. Now, what happens if you have another virtual network that you can also link to that express route circuit or to that VPN? But it also means that you have eventually many, many firewalls to configure. And this, you know, notwithstanding the cost of these things, sometimes can be a little bit of a challenge. So the topology that I'm going to be using in the discussions today the most is really a hub-and-spoke topology of peered virtual networks, where you have, you know, your workloads that reside in different virtual networks that are peered with a centralized or service virtual network, for example. So why is this a good idea? Well, we think it's a good idea because it allows you to have some scalable infrastructure that you're going to put in a shared infrastructure stamp, which is the one that you see at the bottom, where there's a few things there. It also allows you to share your express route connection and or your VPN connection, should you have decided to use a site-to-site VPN. You don't have to, but it allows you to do that. We think it also simplifies the management of those things, because you don't have to manage as many. You can have many that are in one location, but at least they're all in one virtual network. And the good thing, or the thing that you have to know, is that there is no real performance bottlenecks between virtual networks. So if, for example, Spoke A wants to talk to the hub or to Spoke B, well, if you peer Spoke A and B together, it will be as fast as if they are in the same virtual network. Obviously, if you go through some sort of virtual appliance in the hub to go from A to B, then, you know, you get the performance of going through that virtual appliance. But for anything communicating between the hub and the spoke, you could have 1,000 VMs in each of them talking at 3 gigabits per second each. It doesn't matter, right? There's no gateways. But if you do this, and if you centralize, you know, infrastructures and firewalls and stuff like that, you really want to make sure that you have something that's very resilient and highly available in your centralized infrastructure. This is what we're going to be talking a little bit about today. So what, you know, just to get back on, what do we typically see in a spoke? Well, we see line of business applications. You can think of database servers, web applications, or tiered applications where you have a front end, a back end, and a business tier there. And the traffic, even between the subnets that exist inside of a spoke, it can definitely go through firewalls that is centralized. You don't have to think of this as separate networks. It is a logical separation of the networks, but it does not, you know, prevent the machines to go through the centralized firewalls, just like if they were in the same VNet, from a performance standpoint, it is pretty much the same, right? So you can do intra-subnet filtering, inter-subnet filtering, and inter-VNet filtering. And intra-subnet filtering is something that sometimes people are surprised about. That is very easy to do. It looks like micro-segmentation that you would do on premises, where even two hosts in the same subnet might be forced to, depending on the policies that you implement in Azure, go through some kind of firewall device. And what's in the hub? Well, today I'm specifically going to talk about network virtual appliances, but clearly there's other things. There's domain controllers that you could put there, monitoring servers, DNS, a secure access workstation, you know, all kinds of things that you could imagine, as well as maybe centralized applications, you know, that other organizations or lines of businesses within your organizations are using. So that's there. Now, the main topic of the day is high availability with virtual appliances. So basically, I can think of two kinds of approaches for that. So the first one is the active and passive network virtual appliance, which is a little bit more of a classic, sounds weird to say classic when we're talking about the cloud, but the way that people do today, most people do today. So using user-defined rules to point, user-defined routes, to point to an active firewall instance and to have the public addresses either applied to a VM or to an internet-facing load balancer. That would be two different scenarios or sub-scenarios of this active and passive virtual appliance scenario. And we're going to be going through a little bit more details in each of these scenario A and Bs. And the other one, which is the one that I think is much more cloud-like, because it's an active, and I could say active n times, because they are in parallel. So think of this as a scale out, where you're very aware that you are able to scale out things like virtual machines if you have, you know, several web servers behind the load balancer. Well, you can do the same using firewalls. So this scenario will depend on having multiple IPs on the internet-facing load balancer if you have multiple workloads behind. If you're only using this sets of firewall as an outbound set of firewall, you wouldn't need that. But if you're using it for outbound and inbound or only for inbound, then you would apply the public IPs to the external load balancer. The other thing also is you need to point the UDR, so a user-defined route, to an internal load balancer. Now, this is a feature that is still in preview, but it's been there for some time. It works extremely well. I wouldn't fear to use this particular thing, but I understand that certain organizations might rather wait for this. And the other thing that is also in preview, but critical for this to work, at least if you have the same set of firewalls that's used for both inbound and outbound internet access, is the ability to have a back-end pool the back-end pool of a load balancer that is on the secondary NIC. And this is to be GA'd by the end of this month. So definitely if you're starting to think about that and worry about the fact that this is not GA, well, this particular case will be GA soon. So if we're looking, coming back to the active and passive scenario, there's a lot of appliance vendors that use this today, where there's, you know, you have your VM that runs, or VMs, right, that run internally, and you have a public IP. In the scenario A, the public IP is applied directly to the firewall, FW1 in this case. And the UDR would point to the active instance, which is FW1. So you have one firewall that's active and one firewall that's passive. And the throughput that those firewalls, I get, and my peers get this question quite often now, how fast do you think those firewalls go or can go? Well, it really depends on the virtual machine size and, quite frankly, on what runs on that virtual machine. Because if you think about it, if you have deep inspection, layer 7 inspection, for example, that's being done by one firewall, obviously this takes a toll on the CPU and ultimately reduces the speed at which packets are processed by this machine. And this is something that you want to pay attention to, especially if you have an active-passive scenario. You want to make sure you have something that's fast enough for what your needs are. And this scenario works very well. And today with single instance SLA, I believe the, Eddie, can you, do you remember what the single instance SLA is? Is it like 99.9?
Yeah, that's correct. 99.9 is single instance SLA as long as it's on a premium VM. So it has to be like a DS or a GS series.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Eddie. So depending on which, you know, certain customers are perfectly happy with this, and we're coming with technologies that such that when we're doing our upgrades, it impacts less and less the virtual machine. So it's a very, it works very well, and a lot of vendors use this actually. So if we look a little bit more at what the outbound flows, so on the right-hand side, you have your virtual network, and you have a machine or several machines and a UDR, as I said earlier, that's applied to the machine number one. So what happens is that when there's a packet that leaves the VM on the right, the packet gets trapped or captured by the Azure Fabric. Remember, Azure does not necessarily work. In fact, it does not work like a physical network. It's an SDN-based network. So there's a lot of concepts that are different. So when the packet exits the virtual NIC of that virtual machine, it's captured by the hypervisor and looked up on the effective route table, which is a term that you guys should know if you're troubleshooting these things or implementing these things, because it will tell you what is the next hop. So really the virtual machine and that's equally good for a firewall and any other virtual machine, as they let packet out of their interfaces, they don't have anything to say as to where that packet is going. So putting a static route on the host to send it to the .5 is useless. If it has one NIC, it can only send it out the NIC. It can try to send it to .5. It doesn't matter. Azure will take it and will send it to where the destination should be. And this varies based on if there's a UDR or not, or if there's routes that come from BGP or, you know, cross-premises connections, which could be BGP or statically defined. All that to say that the packets get sent to the internal NIC of that firewall, right? And then that firewall will source NAT that traffic because it's coming to its private interface. Now it's going to send it out its other NIC. So there, in this scenario, those firewalls both have two NICs. And it's going to source NAT the traffic of the internal host to its external IP. Now what happens is that this external IP of the firewall is not a public IP. It's an IP that lives inside of your virtual network address space. So as you have a public IP that's associated with this private IP, the packet will get source NATed again to the Azure public IP with which it is going to ultimately reach the internet host. So that's the IP that the internet host will see. It won't see the outside interface of the private outside interface of the firewall one. It will see the public IP that's associated with this IP, right? And very soon, and that's also by the end of the month, we should be able to have, and people who have the preview can do this right now, up to 250 private IPs on a NIC, and you can bind one public IP to each of these private IPs if you want. So in the end, you can have up to 250 IPs on this outbound flow. So that's an example of an outbound flow. So same scenario if we're thinking about an inbound flow. Then the packets, sent by some phone or mobile device or whatever the device is targeting the public IP of Azure. And and what happens at that point is this gets denatted. So destination NAT, the public IP, the target IP might be 23 something, 23111, and this gets DNATed to the private IP, the internal IP of that firewall. And then that firewall will receive the packet. The active firewall will receive the packet because it's the one that has the public IP, right? And then the firewall will DNAT this to the ultimate internal IP of that machine and will send that packet directly to that machine. So the return traffic will follow what we've seen on the previous slide. That's kind of the idea. So if we look at this, what happens when there's a failover? When firewall one goes south for some reason. So you see there, the public IP has to change. If that public IP for you is important. It might be that you have different public IPs on both firewalls and you wouldn't need to change that. So in this case, it would be a faster failover because you would only have the UDR that's changing, right? So, multiple network appliance vendors are implementing these using API calls to Azure. So what they do is with an API call, they change the UDR. So I showed an accelerated version of this because in reality, it takes anywhere between 30 seconds and 2 minutes. And the public IPs as well, they need to, if they're important for you, if it is important for you that those public IPs follow the firewall, and it probably is in many cases, well, you will have to migrate those public IPs from firewall one to firewall two. So that in general is how it works or how this scenario, this particular scenario works. So for vendors that don't implement those API calls, we built something inside of Microsoft and feel free to reach out to your account teams if you want to learn more or if you need this is, we have something that's built off of containers and Zookeeper, and there's a cluster that runs inside of your virtual networks and check out for these firewalls and how they, you know, how they are and what their health status is. And upon detection of firewall one being out, it would initiate this transfer for you. So even if you would run some applications or not applications, but virtual appliances that don't support this, there's still a way to make it happen. So. That's for the active passive first scenario. So let's go into the second scenario. So scenario B. In this case, instead, remember in the previous scenario, the public IP, as I said, was assigned to the firewall one. Really to the, it's actually assigned to a NIC or to an IP, to be more precise, in the hierarchy of objects, there's the VM, below which there's the NIC. And under the NIC, there's something called IP configuration. So an IP configuration is a private IP address to which you can allocate the public IP. So this was how it was done in scenario A. Now in scenario B, the difference is that the public IP is assigned instead to the internet facing load balancer. But in order for that to work, you need to make sure that the standby firewall is not going to answer to health probes of the internet facing load balancer. Because what happens if firewall 2 answers to those probes is that some flows are going to be sent to firewall 2. Firewall 2 is going to send this inbound flow to the machine internally. However, the reply packet is not going to go to firewall 2 because the UDR points it to firewall 1. So outside of this public IP that's actually allocated to the internet facing load balancer is it's the same as scenario A. Hopefully that makes sense. So, we'll look at what an outbound flow would be from that perspective. Pretty much the same, right? So, a packet that leaves the VM, that lives internally, will end up following the UDR to go to firewall one. Firewall one would do its magic, source NAT this to one of the firewall's IP, and it's illustrated here that it goes through the load balancer. In reality, it sends it straight out. It's the return traffic that will go through the load balancer. This is just how Azure is designed. So it gets source NATed to, at that point, it gets source NATed to one of the IPs of the firewall, 1 to 250 if you so desire. And then in much the same way, it gets source NATed to a public IP, of that of that internet facing load balancer. So this is for outbound flows. Now, the inbound flows are a little bit different in that they're sent conceptually slightly different, but in reality, it goes through pretty much the same path. So the packet is leaving some host on the internet, either a return packet of the previous outbound flow or a session that's initiated from the internet will reach the load balancer. And the load balancer will do that translation to the instance that answers to the health probes. This is why I said before that in this case, because UDR is pointing to firewall 1, you need to make sure that firewall 2 does not answer health probes. Not for now. It can only answer the health probes when firewall 1 is down. Otherwise, you will get asymmetric routing and probably failure unless you configure your firewall to deal with it. And some people do that. And it's perfectly fine. So once the flow reaches the internet facing load balancer, it gets redirected to the active instance. And finally denatted, destination NAT. So that public IP that was pointing to the firewall and ends up pointing to some virtual machine that runs inside of that virtual network, or something that's accessible via IP. You could think that this could be some host that you have on-prem if you want, through Express Route, through VPN. Typically, it's probably more in the virtual network, but it's anything that's reachable via the firewall, really. So, active, passive scenarios, as I said, you need to keep your NVAs happy and your logs happy using UDRs. Because if you look at this little TCP SYN packet there, you get an illustration that it is, well, I don't show that if it goes on the other firewall, it's going to fail, but let's just assume it will. In general, I'm not saying that no firewalls can be configured to do otherwise, but in general, it's not going to work. So this was all about the active, passive scenarios. But the one that I think is more interesting from a cloud perspective is really the active scale out topology. So you could have multiple firewalls if you want and just scale them out. Just like you have, you know, you can scale out and configure actually automatic scale out of certain of your web services, for example. Or if you create yourself a VM scale set, you can scale out based on CPU usage or other metrics. You conceptually could think of eventually doing the same, although the firewall vendors will have to abide to that, and then we'll have to embrace this virtual machine scale set. But you could always do it without a virtual machine scale set, like I did. I just created an availability set. But I guess the point is, if you need more, you can have more. And if everything and anything that you have in the topology, the VNet topology we were looking at earlier, if everything is there, well, if every host that needs to talk to every host go through those firewalls, you will definitely need more than one firewall, and probably more than two, depending on the bandwidth. Again, this is always improving. The bandwidth our VMs are able to handle is improving, and the firewall vendors are working with this, with this improved performance. But if you need 10 gigabits per second of firewalling, we'll probably need more than two instances. So essentially it provides more or less infinite bandwidth. That's debatable. It's not necessarily infinite, but if you have 100 VMs, it starts to be quite a lot of bandwidth. Plus when you have this kind of topology, when you think about it, if you're upgrading one of your firewalls, if you have 12 firewalls or 10 and you're upgrading one, well, the impact is only on one. Same goes for if Azure does some upgrades and you put them all in different update domains. Well, the impact on your total performance is much lower. So this is an interesting topology. So from my standpoint, so thinking about outbound flows. So here you got the topology with the VM that's inside. You still have a UDR, right? The UDR is important because it will impact the flow of the packet. It will choose where the packet will go, and instead of sending the packet to one active instance firewall, like we had in the previous scenario. We send it to the virtual IP of that load balancer. So, and the load balancer, based off of the state, the health state of the firewall, will send it to maybe firewall one. And then, depending on the external load IP, external or internet-facing load balancer configuration, it could be source NATed to one IP of the firewall, or it could be, it could be assigned to the IP of the load balancer or the IP of the firewall, and that depends on how you want your things to work. If you want everybody to always have the same IP, we typically go through the second model and assign it to the load balancer. There's configuration details there, but this is the idea. Now, if we think of inbound flows, typically you will have a number of public IPs that are allocated to your internet-facing load balancer. If you want this to be resilient, you would not point to a public IP that's on one specific firewall, because that won't work if that firewall is down. So you would typically point that flow and expose that public IP or that domain name or CNAME of yours that points to this public IP to the internet-facing load balancer, which is the one that the arrow is pointing to. Now, same as before, this internet-facing load balancer will DNAT, destination NAT, so change the destination IP of this public IP, maybe 23.1.1.1. I'd like to use this as an example, and to send it maybe to 10.0.0.0.5, maybe, which is firewall number two. And then the firewall will source NAT. This is, it's not DNAT, it's source NAT, right, to ensure symmetric routing. What happens if it does not? Well, if it does not, the return flow might go through firewall one or firewall three, and that might break, depending again on your configuration. And the drawback of this is that the host internally will not see the IP of the client, will see the IP of the firewall or an IP that the firewall decides. So you might need to do some log correlation. I have some of the pros and cons later of different topologies, but this is important for the flows to work well in both directions. Now, as I had in the previous example, just going to show a quick example of how the flows could work. And if you don't have that source NATing that I talked, what happens is what we just saw. So solutions is source NATing at the firewall, such that the packet source IP in this case is the firewall one, and the return SYN ACK will go through the firewall one, and the firewall one will do what it has to do to send that packet outbound back on the internet. If this is a problem, there could be, you could have a load balanced pool of firewalls that, and I don't know if, I know that some vendors might be working on stuff to improve their stories. And when I say their stories is in term of, having those firewalls in parallel. So, you know, we're going to see how those guys are going to work in making those solutions work in this world, in this highly parallelized world. However, I think that the source NAT is the easy way to do it today, and it works. And if you guys are using load balancers, and not Microsoft Azure load balancers, but third-party load balancers, in many cases, this is how they work anyway. So they source NAT the traffic, and they can add things like X-forwarded for in case of web traffic, such that the client knows who is the original requester. This is a very common thing to do. So, what are the different building blocks that I talked about? First one is the user-defined routes. And strangely, we call them route tables in our Azure portal, but user-defined routes in our documentation. But they're meant to be the same. User-defined routes can be applied in subnets. Well, that's the only place where they can be applied, really. And you can have them applied in different spokes and different subnets of the spokes and different subnets of the hub. and send all traffic to the virtual IP. In that case, well, if it's, you know, if it's the active passive scenario, you would send it to the active instance. But if it's the case that you're rather sending it through a load balanced set, in that case, you would point it to the virtual IP. Again, this is a preview feature, to the ability to send it to the virtual IP of that load balancer. The advantage of doing this, obviously, is that you don't need to wait too long on Azure to realize that this firewall is down. If you firewall one would just stop working, for example. There's many flows that the load balancer already sends to firewall two, and it will detect that firewall one is down and will stop sending new flows to firewall one. And that detection process does not take a lot of time. It takes a few seconds. So for the internet facing load balancer, so if you're using the same set of firewall for both inbound flows and outbound flows, and let's say more like out sessions that are initiated from the outside and sessions that are initiated from the inside. You could very well have two different sets of firewalls because you might have critical business apps that you really want that firewalling capability to be dedicated to that. I've seen this in large enterprises quite a few times, and have other firewalls that are there to browse the internet or to, you know, secure inter subnet or inter host or inter VNet or cross premise communications, for example. So if you use this, that set of firewall for the both directions of flows, you need to pay attention to one thing. And that thing is the probes there. But I'll start with the internet-facing load balancer, where you would have, as what I explained before, multiple public IPs that are balanced there, and you would probably use direct server return. You don't have to, but direct server return, when it comes to load balancing, is a very practical thing in certain specific scenarios. One scenario we have in our documentation is the one that talks about SQL always on. Now we're clearly in the networking world, so we're not going to talk about SQL, but we're going to talk about networking, and in networking, if you want to make your lives easier, you would probably want to use this. And the reason is that if you have, for example, public IP 23111 or 1234 in my example on the slide, that means that you would configure that rule on the load balancer to be DSR enabled, and it means that the 1234, your virtual machines will actually see packets that are sent to 1234. And once they see that packet, they will denat it, for example, to 192.168.16.8. And both of the firewalls would do the same denat operation. So what that means for you is your firewall configurations as far as denat are the same. Even if you have five firewalls in parallel, you would have the same. Otherwise, you would have to play around with ports. And, you know, from the outside, it doesn't change. But from the inside, it's not a detailed deck on how the load balancers work, but essentially it would all send them to the external IP of that firewall, and all public IPs would map to a different port on the same IP. So I think this is not ideal, and I think this is much easier to deal with. I'm seeing questions in the IM. I don't know if... Okay, so I'll feel free, Eddie, to respond if you can to those questions. Otherwise, I'll get the mics.
Brian and I have answered almost all of them. The only one that hasn't been answered right now is we have a timeline for the ILB next hop to be in GA.
Yeah, this I do not know for now. Sorry, Brian, I didn't notice that you were online. So for the internet facing load balancer, the probes, and this is for the health probe, and this is a critical piece. This is what will make such that the Azure load balancer sends requests to your firewall, to which, you know, the healthy firewalls. The challenge, and it's only a challenge if you use the same set of firewalls for both inbound and outbound flows, is that both probes, or all probes, are sourced from a specific Azure IP, which is a special IP, which is nothing to be worried about because this is a Microsoft IP that's used for DHCP, for DNS, for health probes, for a whole bunch of other stuff. in Azure, and it's also used by the health pros. All that to say that this IP is the IP that's going to query for the health status of your firewalls. So you can do two things. Typically, you could send it to a listening endpoint on your firewall, which will only validate that your firewall is up and running, or actually the outside interface of that firewall is up and running. But if I were to do this in a real life scenario, I would probably rather point it to some VIP that I have internally that would validate that my firewall is able to see that, you know, it processes the packets, that the rules on the firewalls are good, the routing is good, it validates much more things. Whenever the probe stops answering or the you know, virtual firewall crashes or something, you can think of a failover time of around 9 to 13 seconds. That's kind of what we've seen. If you're using this also for, just give me one second. Okay, so if you use this for the internal load balancer, the ILB IP address, so the VIP, is going to be the target of the user-defined routes that you've configured on different subnets. And as I said, if you're using the same set of firewalls for both probes, for both inbound and outbound flows, both probes are going to come from 168.63.129.16. And that's going to be sent to the internal IP of the firewall. Again, you could terminate this on the firewall, or you could use a well-known service on the internet that you think is always going to be up, find that IP of this, or you might have something on the outside of your firewall that has a VIP and you know that's always going to be responsive. If you want to, you know, see that the whole thing works and not just the firewall answers to the probe. Again, same kind of failover time because it's exactly the same functionality. And it will require, though, that you do, if, again, you're using the same set of firewalls for inbound and outbound flows, it will require that you do some sort of policy-based routing. And the reason for that is simple. Azure will query your external NIC on your firewall and expect, you know, and it's a public IP, right? So the source of this is 168-something. Your firewall, in all likelihood, has a default route that points to its external IP or untrusted IP, untrusted NIC, and it will therefore point to the .1 maybe of that subnet. So typically when your firewall will receive a request from 168, it will want to answer through its default route because it appears to be something very similar to the internet. Now, if your firewall is receiving also probes for this same 168 IP that comes off to the internal IP, it will also be tempted to respond through its external NIC. And that entirely depends on the configuration of your virtual machines or your firewalls. So depending on the firewall vendor, they are able to do policy-based routing to fix that. What I've done is I've built a lab, and I will be sharing in the next few minutes a little bit of the tests, and this is all based on Linux and all based on IP tables. So multiple appliance vendors will work in these configurations, assuming that they can do policy-based routing and assuming that you're okay to do source NAT for inbound flows such that the return traffic goes to the right firewall. Or, as I said, if you choose that you're comfortable that flows don't necessarily in and out go through the same device, if that works for you, many that I know of, at least firewalls, can be configured to ignore the asymmetric routing. So at that point, it's up to you. Things you need to think about. UDR to load balancer involves that the number of rules that you can have, and a rule, if you're familiar with the load balancer, will tell you, okay, this outbound port, map it to this inbound port. So what does that mean? 150 rules means 150 ports. Could be a combination of TCP ports and UDP ports. Can be you know, any kind of combination. Eventually that limit will go away. I don't have visibility over when that will be. Now, as I said, if you want to have your all your VMs in parallel, you will have to source NAT on different flows to make sure that it comes back through the appropriate device. In other cases, there's HTTP endpoints that, you know, or devices that are able to, and appliances that are able to insert something like X.404, which the web server internally would be able to know who's the original requester. That works for HTTP, might not work for everything else. Otherwise, you can always correlate the logs of your firewall, so you know that session X was ongoing at this time from this source IP and this port, and then actually corresponded to this other source IP, external source, you know, and correlate that with the app server. It's more work, but it allows you to have a very high amount of bandwidth. And as I said, load balancer, health probes, and NDAs, you'll need to have policy-based routing for this. Another thing that you might want to think about if you want to have this scale automatically, if you don't want to have it scale automatically, it's not a big problem. You could just set them up and they all work. But if you want to provision them automatically as workload increase, you could pre-provision them, and I guess that will depend on the NVA vendors. If you're going to use something like IP tables on Linux, I haven't spoken with many customers who use this in a production environment, but if you did this, I guess you would simply use desired state configuration on Azure. And this would allow you to run some scripts that do the configuration and pre-configure things in advance. You could also, with firewall vendors, they probably have some sort of a provisioning or automated provisioning process that could pre-configure the right source NAT and DNATs and these kinds of things. And enhance the probes, as I said before. If you have the firewalls that are answering the probes themselves, it only tells you the firewall is able to answer the TCP port. In a real-life scenario, I would strongly suggest that you instead test for a workload that's on the other end, such that you know that the device does not only answer to a TCP ping, sort of, but goes beyond that and is able to forward the packet, which is essentially what you want to verify. So, I'll be showing in the next few minutes a little bit of a firewall demo that's based off of Linux. So let me, before I do this, that's the topology. And by the way, the deck will be available and the recording will be available too. So you'll be able to look at this stuff. But this is essentially the topology that I'm using here. So there's the VNet A on the top left and VNet B on the top right. And virtual machines that exist there, plus in my scenario only have two firewalls, but they use the same thing, right? So it's based on Linux, so IP tables and netfilter. Not going to go through deep stuff in there, but feel free to look it up after. And there's a whole bunch of hooks there, and if you guys are familiar with netfilter and with IP table, you know that there is a filter table and a NAT table, and the only thing that I really did in this lab is to configure all the post routing and pre routing chain of the NAT table, which is what's important for our demo. So the important pieces that we had there is to make sure that we have, you know, as the packets are traversing the firewall en route to those IPs, they're, you know, changed to the IP of the firewall one. Firewall two would be the .5, but this is essentially how it goes. And for other flows that are initiated from inside to the internet, they get source netted to the external IP of that firewall, which is the one there. Another one that I've used is this DNAT rule for an inbound flow. So that says essentially anything except this special Azure IP that's sent to this send it to one specific host internally. So this is the real IP, public IP that I talked about, that the firewall will see. So the firewall will really see a flow coming to 1378.239.131 in that case. Actually, in my lab, it's become a different IP, but this is how it works. And obviously, as I said earlier on, this firewall has two NICs. So an external NIC and an internal NIC, the external being ETH0 and ETH1 being the internal NIC. So you have the default route on the top that points to the outside world. And those things are pointing to my internal VNets. So as I said, if the firewall sends it to the .10, so instead here, if it sent it to the .10, it does not influence how Azure deals with it. Azure just receives the packet through ETH1 and then will route it to the appropriate virtual network. And we've used Netcat to, you know, respond to the probes from Azure. And a custom route table that's being used. I'm going fast again, but this is Linux details, and I want you to understand more of the concept rather than teaching you Linux, which I have peers that are better than me to do this. That said, this is for the policy-based routing that I talked about. So the probes that are coming to the internal IP, this is the internal IP of the firewall. From this, it sends it to a route table here that just says, send it out your internal IP, please, instead of following the default route, which otherwise would send it out of the external IP of that firewall, which Azure will reject. Other details here, if you want to make this persistent across reboots, you would do something like that. So before moving to the Q&A, I will show a little bit of a test here. So hopefully my stuff is still working. Excellent. So on the bottom left and right, you have two firewalls. So FW1 and FW2. And on the top left here is a client that lives, it's, you know, in VNet A, subnet 1, that is connected to this whole thing. So if I go and I just browse, this is, for those of you who don't know, curl is a way to navigate the internet from a command line, which is not very practical, depending on what you do. But, you know, if you're just browsing to see if something works or to download a file or to whatever, this is quite practical. And this IP, info.io, web server, returns interesting information. So it returns where you are from. So you appear to be from here, which happens to be the public IP of my firewall one here. And if I do it again, I might hit the same one for some time, and eventually I might hit the other one. But if I want to force things a little bit, I could do something like this, if down ETH1, and this is going to shut down the internal IP of firewall one, which this guy no longer tests. So normally I would expect that pretty soon I'll see a different IP. So right now the load balancer is probably still sending it to the existing machine, but then it sended it to the other one. So you see the 218. So the IP here is not the same as the IP there, which tells you that it changed. And in this case, we didn't migrate the public IP. It's just used for outbound access. So if I'm going to just bring this back up again, and if I decide that I use this one, and I shut it down, then quite quickly, this is going to go to the .68. Now it is probable that it appeared to take less time because there's only one session at a time, but normally it takes between 9 and 15, 14 seconds to happen. And another test, what I have on the right-hand side, on the top right, is actually my host at home. So this is my home computer, and I will use this to browse using the same command, using Ubuntu on my Windows 10, and I'm browsing this 1378.168.76 on port 2022. This is an example that I've worked on. And so as you do this, you would normally see IP address of a web server that lives inside of VNetB. Right, so if we remember the topology, I'll bring it back up here for a moment. So there is a web server that's on the right here that answers to these requests. And it tells you what client IP I appear from. And obviously the IP of my workstation at home is not 192.168.1.4. It's some public IP. And in fact, I could just go there, ipinfo.io, and you see that this is my public IP. Yet the server in Azure just tells me that you're coming off of this. And why? Well, again, this is because we're source NATed by Firewall 1 in this case. So, I won't go into too many details, more than I did already, but that brings me to the end of this presentation. So I'm at the top of the hour, I realize. So I'll open up the mics if you guys have questions that are unanswered, and you want to unmute yourselves, feel free to do so. Hopefully this was helpful. That's for one thing.
Hey, Olivia.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. quick question on the app service environment. Even with the ILB configuration, there's that public IP address that needs to be able to see out to multiple data centers in the Azure IP network, and the technique that you would use in your configuration to allow that, correct me if I'm wrong, would be you would create a static NAT rule that says when that public IP address tries to leave through the firewall, you let it keep its public IP address and don't allow it to be source NATed. Is that correct?
Repeat that a little more slowly. I will focus very hard. Okay. Otherwise, we can't take it offline after, but let's try again.
All right. Real quick. The ASE ILB.
Yes.
It's built in a VNet, but it still has a public IP address.
Yeah.
If I want that public IP address allowed to go out and not be changed, not be source NATed, that's just a straight static NAT rule, right, that you would create in your environment?
If you want to allow – okay, yeah. So services like the ACE – and this is one particular case where my peer Brian and I have worked, and Brian has worked extensively on understanding the details, the intricate details of how it works. But there's, you would not be able, for example, to have, some of these services force them to go through a firewall. If the service has a public endpoint or needs to access the public internet, it is challenging sometimes to route this back through certain things. If for example, you have if you have a firewall, just like in the scenario for inbound flows that acts as a proxy to hit that ILB, that ILB ACE, that ACE would not know it comes from the outside world. So in that case, there's probably a way of making it work. But otherwise, it's not necessarily going to work as you intend in some cases. And as Brian is pointing it out in the IM as well, if any VM in there has a public IP or needs to talk to the internet using its own public IP for validation of the service states and stuff, this topology, you might have to leave it alone and leave it, live in some portion of your virtual network. And there's still, you know, there's stuff that you can do to secure it using NSGs and the like, but not everything can be sent through these firewalls. It depends. In IaaS, normally, it's really not a problem. But in PaaS, it depends on the service.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions from the audience? Well, if not, guys, it's been a pleasure on my end. I hope it was useful for you guys, and I hope you get some good understanding of what we do in Azure, and specifically around the high availability of virtual appliances. And we'll see each other in 2 weeks. Until then, have a great rest of day, evening, night, morning, and a fantastic weekend. Bye, everyone.